You now have 1 minute to read the questions. The recording will then start automatically and play once. You cannot pause, rewind, or fast forward the recording. Hablas español? Parlez-vous français? Ni hui shuo zhong wen ma? If you answered si, oui, or should da, and you're listening to this in English, chances are you belong to the world's bilingual and multilingual majority. And besides having an easier time traveling or watching movies without subtitles, knowing two or more languages means that your brain may actually look and work differently than those of your monolingual friends. So what does it really mean to know a language? Language ability is typically measured in two active parts, speaking and writing, and two passive parts, listening and reading. While a balanced bilingual has near equal abilities across the board in two languages, most bilinguals around the world know and use their languages in varying proportions. And depending on their situation and how they acquired each language, they can be classified into three general types. For example, let's take Gabriella, whose family immigrated to the US from Peru when she was 2 years old. As a compound bilingual, Gabriella developed two linguistic codes simultaneously with a single set of concepts, learning both English and Spanish as she began to process the world around her. Her teenage brother, on the other hand, might be a coordinate bilingual, working with two sets of concepts, learning English in school while continuing to speak Spanish at home and with friends. Finally, Gabriella's parents are likely to be subordinate bilinguals, who learn a secondary language by filtering it through their primary language. Because all types of bilingual people can become fully proficient in a language, regardless of accent or pronunciation, the difference may not be apparent to a casual observer. But recent advances in brain imaging technology have given neurolinguists an idea of how specific aspects of language learning affect the bilingual brain. It's well known that the brain's left half is more dominant and analytical in logical processes, while the right half is more active in emotional and social ones, though this is a matter of degree, not an absolute split. The fact that language involves both types of functions, while lateralization develops gradually with age, has led to the critical period hypothesis. According to this theory, children learn languages more easily because the flexibility of their developing brains lets them use both halves in language acquisition, while in most adults, language is lateralized to one half, usually the left. If this is true, learning a language in childhood may give you a more comprehensive idea of its social and emotional contexts. Similarly, recent research shows that people who learned a second language in adulthood show less emotional bias and a more rational approach when confronting problems in the second language than in their native one. But regardless of when you acquire additional languages, being multilingual gives your brain some remarkable advantages. The increased workout a bilingual brain receives throughout its life can also help delay the onset of diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia by as much as 5 years. The idea of major cognitive benefits of being bilingual may seem obvious now, but it would have surprised earlier experts. Before the 1960s, bilingualism was considered a handicap that slowed a child's development by forcing them to spend too much energy distinguishing between languages, a view based largely on flawed studies. So while bilingualism may not necessarily make you smarter, it does make your brain healthier, more complex, and actively engaged. And even if you didn't have the good fortune of learning a second language as a child, it's never too late to do yourself a favor and make the linguistic leap from hello to hola, bonjour, or ni hao, because when it comes to our brains, a little exercise can go a long way. You now have 1 minute to read the questions. The recording will then start automatically and play twice. You cannot pause, rewind, or fast forward the recording.
So, Angela, I recently had a near-death experience, and if I died, it would have been, not funny exactly, but at least like an O. Henry short story, because I almost got killed in a traffic accident while driving back from getting my second COVID vaccine shot.
Oh, that would have been a great short story.
Right? I would have been willing to die for that story, but I didn't, alas. So we have this lame version of the story in which the protagonist doesn't even die. But anyway, I got my vaccine early in the morning on a Sunday morning in Queens, which was about a 35 to 40 minute drive from where I live. And I'm driving back and I'm on the Cross Bronx Expressway, which is usually a highway that travels at about half a mile an hour. It's just always jammed up, but on a Sunday morning, it was flying. So everybody's going, you know, not crazy fast, but 55, 60.
Like highway speeds.
Highway speed. And then, all of a sudden, in the middle lane of this three-lane highway, under an overpass. Or would that be under an underpass? I guess under an underpass, was a tractor-trailer parked in the centre lane at a full stop. So I slam on the brakes, and I'm waiting to either fishtail and get killed, or to hit him.
Or to get hit from behind.
And none of those bad things happened. Anyway, here's my point. I didn't die plainly, but it was the closest I've come to death in a long time. Maybe ever. And I expected to have some kind of an emotional reckoning or reassessment. I was grateful, for sure, don't get me wrong, but I did not have one of those Hollywood moments like, I'm going to live every day as if it's my last day. So here's my question for you today. Am I broken? Is something wrong with me?
Are you missing a chip?
Or maybe this means I've got a mature view of death and that maybe even ready to go.
Well, let's come back to that question. Let's explore, a little bit, what people usually say when you have a near-death experience. You know, this whole idea of, like, there's a long, dark tunnel and there's a light. Did you see Soul, the animated movie?
Even though you've told me several times now to see it.
You said you were going to see it, by the way.
I did. I lied. I do a lot of lying with you when you tell me to do things.
You say that you'll do them and then you blithely don't do them.
Well, that's how much I appreciate our friendship. I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to do the thing, but then I don't do it.
Well, okay. The protagonist, who's a jazz musician, has a turn of events in his life. It's like, oh, he finally got a gig. He's going to start his musical career and not just be a music teacher anymore. And then, in his merriment, he falls down this pothole. And you infer that he nearly dies. Because all of a sudden, it's all darkness. There's a tunnel and there's a light. And he's moving towards a light. And that's all in the setup to the movie, which I'll not spoil for you. But I think that's not the interesting thing. Because you weren't like, gosh, I didn't see a long dark tunnel. I think what you were surprised by is what didn't happen to you, but does happen in the movie, which is that this musician puts things in perspective. And over the course of the film, he figures out that what's really important to him in life is not necessarily what he thought it was before the accident. Basically, he figures out the relationships and, you know, enjoying a warm breeze on a summer's day are more important than achievement.
That's a message that Angela Duckworth must have hated. No, get out there and achieve.
I know. I was like, do I get to tell this animated character about the wonders of grit? But no, seriously, it was a shift in his perspective. And you did not have this kind of, like, oh, I've got to zoom out.
Stop and smell the roses.
Or anything, right? You could have also realised, oh, I guess I should work more or whatever. But you didn't have any shift in perspective. You were just like, oh, what's for lunch?
So, Angela, I recently had a near-death experience, and if I died, it would have been not funny exactly, but at least like an O. Henry short story, because I almost got killed in a traffic accident while driving back from getting my second COVID vaccine shot.
Oh, that would have been a great short story.
Right? I would have been willing to die for that story, but I didn't, alas. So we have this lame version of the story in which the protagonist doesn't even die. But anyway, I got my vaccine early in the morning on a Sunday morning in Queens, which was about a 35 to 40 minute drive from where I live. And I'm driving back and I'm on the Cross Bronx Expressway, which is usually a highway that travels at about half a mile an hour. It's just always jammed up. But on a Sunday morning, it was flying. So everybody's going, you know, not crazy fast, but 55, 60.
Like highway speeds.
Highway speed. And then, all of a sudden, in the middle lane of this three-lane highway, under an overpass. Or would that be under an underpass? I guess under an underpass, was a tractor-trailer parked in the centre lane at a full stop. So I slam on the brakes, and I'm waiting to either fishtail and get killed, or to hit him.
Or to get hit from behind.
And none of those bad things happened. Anyway, here's my point. I didn't die plainly, but it was the closest I've come to death in a long time. Maybe ever. And I expected to have some kind of an emotional reckoning or reassessment. I was grateful, for sure, don't get me wrong, but I did not have one of those Hollywood moments like, I'm going to live every day as if it's my last day. So here's my question for you today. Am I broken? Is something wrong with me?
Are you missing a chip?
Or maybe this means I've got a mature view of death and that maybe even ready to go.
Well, let's come back to that question. Let's explore, a little bit, what people usually say when you have a near-death experience. You know, this whole idea of, like, there is a long, dark tunnel and there's a light. Did you see Soul, the animated movie?
Even though you've told me several times now to see it.
You've said you were going to see it, by the way.
I did. I lied. I do a lot of lying with you when you tell me to do things.
You say that you'll do them and then you blithely don't do them.
Well, that's how much I appreciate our friendship. I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to do the thing, but then I don't do it.
Well, okay. The protagonist, who's a jazz musician, has a turn of events in his life. It's like, oh, he finally got a gig. He's going to start his musical career and not just be a music teacher anymore. And then, in his merriment, he falls down this pothole. And you infer that he nearly dies. Because all of a sudden, it's all darkness. There's a tunnel and there's a light. And he's moving towards a light, and that's all in the setup to the movie, which I'll not spoil for you. But I think that's not the interesting thing, because you weren't like, gosh, I didn't see a long dark tunnel. I think what you were surprised by is what didn't happen to you, but does happen in the movie, which is that this musician puts things in perspective. And over the course of the film, he figures out that what's really important to him in life is not necessarily what he thought it was before the accident. Basically, he figures out the relationships and, you know, enjoying a warm breeze on a summer's day are more important than achievement.
That's a message that Angela Duckworth must have hated. No, get out there and achieve.
I know. I was like, do I get to tell this animated character about the wonders of grit? But no, seriously, it was a shift in his perspective. And you did not have this kind of, like, oh, I've got to zoom out.
Stop and smell the roses.
Or anything, right? You could have also realised, oh, I guess I should work more or whatever. But you didn't have any shift in perspective. You were just like, oh, what's for lunch?
Do not press continue until you are ready to move on to the next section of the test. You now have 1 minute to read the questions. The recording will then start automatically and play twice. You cannot pause, rewind, or fast forward the recording.
Speaker A. I took my driving test in 1996, and before the test I was very confident, because I'd actually learnt how to drive a car with my dad years before on a beach. In our local test centre there were two examiners. One was very strict and serious, and the other one was very friendly and nice. When I heard the strict examiner call my name, I got quite nervous. Luckily, the weather was really nice that day, and there weren't many cars on the road. So I was able to pass my test successfully with no issues. Looking back on it now, I was just really happy that I passed my test first time and didn't have to take the test again, because I think that would have been awful.
Speaker B. I was extremely nervous about my fifth driving test because I'd obviously failed the previous four, and the examiner was the toughest one in my area. And up until I reversed into the parking space, I really didn't think I'd passed, but in the end, I did. And I actually hugged the examiner, and even now it makes me smile, because I was so happy and crying, and I didn't really expect to pass. And yeah, it was an amazing feeling, and I look back at it now and wonder why I got so nervous.
Speaker C. I took my driving exam in 2014. I was 16 years old. I passed the written exam with 100%. And the actual driving test with 96%, which I was quite pleased with. I was very worried ahead of time. However, I'd been driving for a year up to that point, and I'd spent many, many hours behind the wheel of the car with my parents and my driving instructor in preparation. I was very happy that I passed on the first go, which doesn't always happen. And I still drive to this day, and I would say I'm quite a confident driver.
Speaker A. I took my driving test in 1996, and before the test I was very confident, because I'd actually learnt how to drive a car with my dad years before on a beach. In our local test centre there were two examiners. One was very strict and serious, and the other one was very friendly and nice. When I heard the strict examiner call my name, I got quite nervous. Luckily, the weather was really nice that day, and there weren't many cars on the road. So I was able to pass my test successfully with no issues. Looking back on it now, I was just really happy that I passed my test first time and didn't have to take the test again, because I think that would have been awful.
Speaker B. I was extremely nervous about my fifth driving test because I'd obviously failed the previous four, and the examiner was the toughest one in my area. And up until I reversed into the parking space, I really didn't think I'd passed. But in the end, I did. And I actually hugged the examiner. And even now it makes me smile, because I was so happy and crying, and I didn't really expect to pass. And yeah, it was an amazing feeling. And I look back at it now and wonder why I got so nervous.
Speaker C. I took my driving exam in 2014. I was 16 years old. I passed the written exam with 100% and the actual driving test with 96%, which I was quite pleased with. I was very worried ahead of time. However, I'd been driving for a year up to that point and I'd spent many, many hours behind the wheel of the car with my parents and my driving instructor in preparation. I was very happy that I passed on the first go, which doesn't always happen. And I still drive to this day. And I would say I'm quite a confident driver.
Do not press continue until you are ready to move on to the next section of the test.